it's going to hurt, and that's right. Okay.
It was nighttime, and we were struck by a drunken high driver. All the future we thought we had were taken from us, and life felt meaningless.
How do you pick yourself up off the floor? How do you roll out of bed in the morning?
I knew I had to sort of take some kind of active steps towards re-engaging with life. You're alive and they're not.
We try to cure everything. But yet when it comes to grief, we're like, oh no, no, but not that one. What made you put your heart out there again in that way? I'm Dr. Amy Robbins, and welcome to Life, Death, and the Space Between podcast. I'm a licensed clinical psychologist and medium, and here we explore life, death, consciousness, and what it all means. Today, I have an incredible, incredible guest on the show. Colin Campbell is a writer and director for theater and film. The short film he wrote and directed with his beautiful and talented wife, Cirilio, was nominated for an Academy Award. Campbell teaches screenwriting at Chapman University and theater at California State Polytech University in Pomona. He has a BA from the University of Pennsylvania and an MFA from Columbia. Campbell's highly anticipated solo performance piece, Grief, a one-man shit show, premiered at the Hollywood Fringe Festival, where it won Best Broadwater Award, and just closed in New York. Finding the words, working through profound loss with hope and purpose, is his first book out now. Welcome, Colin.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
So before we get into your story, I want to share my experience in coming across your work. So I was sitting in an airport, heading out to visit my parents and do some work on some of my podcast and everything out in California. And it popped up and I started reading it and started crying in the airport and wanted to distance myself from it. I noticed that I was like, I'm not sure I can read this. And I read a lot about grief. I have three children of my own. What you shared, and we'll get into it, really stirred up a lot for me emotionally. And this is what I do for a living, right? Like, I'm a therapist. I work with people who have lost children, parents, you know, siblings. And then it kept popping up. You kept popping up in my social media feed. Your book, what you say about finding words, and this notion that there are no words, the thing that most people say, particularly when parents lose children. And I thought, I really want to reach out. I really want to read this story, even though I know it is going to be excruciatingly painful to read. And I'm sharing all of this because I think that this is likely what a lot of people who are surrounding those they love who have lost in the way you have feel. And so they back away and they don't engage and they don't connect because they don't want to feel the depth of the pain that is grief.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to give that, you know, start by opening up with that, because I think it's not, and I'm aware of it because it's what I do. So I have this kind of meta awareness of why I'm feeling it. And I work hard to understand it. But I think for so many people who don't, it can be so hard for them to sit with someone else in their pain and grief.
Yeah. Yeah. I think a lot of us are scared of pain. And a lot of behavior and choices we make in our lives are to avoid pain and discomfort. And I think one of the things I learned, unfortunately, through my loss is that I found that I had to lean into the pain, that if I was going to function in the world, if I was going to allow myself to still enjoy and appreciate the love that I shared with my children, there was no way other than leaning into the pain, because the only other choice is avoidance. So if I'm avoiding my pain, I'm avoiding the memories I've had of Ruby and Heart, right? Because it's going to cause pain. So the joy and the pain are mixed in a way that that sort of taught me to not be scared of the pain.
So I know we're so, I wanted to kind of use that as a little bit of a backdrop, but let's start. Tell me about Ruby and Hart and their lives and who they were. Like, what were the unique fingerprints of who they were and how they lived?
Oh, thank you for asking. Yeah. I remember it was the second night of Shiva, and, you know, we were surrounded by people at our home. It was the second night after the funeral, for those of you who aren't Jewish. And I said to the assembled people, I know everyone thinks that their kid is the greatest, but actually my kids were the greatest. they actually were, objectively, which I know I can't really say that, but that's how I really,
pretty spectacular.
Really
felt. In
yeah,
the world,
they're special. So. They are special. So the first thing I want to say is just they were incredibly cool. they were very proud of who they were. They were in touch with who they were, and they were very, very kind. Mm-hmm. So they were like magnets. I mean, one friend of Ruby's just described her as magnetic, and that was true for both of them. People were just drawn to these kids. They were, in many ways, the life of the party, especially Hart. He was like the life of the party. Any party we'd go to, he always wanted to stay home. He's like a homebody. But then once he got to the party, he always had the best time. Everybody always just wanted to be around him, and he was just the life of the party, or if we threw a party. and so he was a clown. He was like a nonstop, you know, right from the get-go, even as a little child, he was the clown. He would just create these personas, and they all had names, and his friends knew them by name, and they'd call them out. They'd say, oh, do Sarah, you know, do Richard. Like they turn into these characters and play these characters to the delight of his friends. and so he was an artist in that sense, creating these wonderfully ridiculous and often inappropriate characters. He was a 14-year-old boy, and some of his humor, as I said, there was a ceremony at his school, which was held in the chapel. It was an Episcopalian school, and I said, you know, I spoke to the whole high school class after his death, and it was quite beautiful that they allowed me to talk about my Ruby and Hart. And I said, I can't really share any of his jokes because they're all inappropriate for chapel.
For those of you who have reached out on Patreon and donated, thank you so much for heeding that call. Thank you. If you have not yet supported the podcast, please go to Patreon, put in Dr. Amy Robbins, and there is an opportunity to support at whatever feels comfortable for you. It helps me with the production costs. My small, very small, but mighty team, it helps keep all of that running. So if you are a fan of the podcast, please consider donating whatever feels good to you. $5 a month, $20 a month. Please take a minute and donate. Also, I am so excited that my course that I have been working on for years is getting ready. We're getting closer. It will be launched at some point this year. So if you're interested, please go ahead and put yourself on the wait list on my website at dramyrobbins.com. Also, if you happen to have any companies that you think are aligned with the vibe of this podcast, I'm looking for sponsorships as well. And the best thing you can do to help this podcast is to spread it via word of mouth. I know so many of you have already said, I've shared this with my friend, or even therapists have shared it with their patients and patients have shared it with therapists. If you love the podcast, please, please share it. We have an online global reach here. So go ahead, tell your friends, tell your family, rate and review the podcast. Just spread the word so we can continue spreading messages of love and light and consciousness and awareness and science and spirituality and just how to live the most meaningful life that you possibly can. Please support Life, Death, and the Space Between.
But then Ruby was an amazing artist. So she discovered visual arts kind of late in her life. She was a reader, a voracious reader, and like a scientific mind mm-hmm. when she was younger. This brilliant, brilliant mind. And then she turned to art right around when she was 14 or 15. She struggled with suicidality and OCD mm-hmm. and depression. And that was very hard for us because she was such a radiant light until suddenly she was, you know, she was racked with OCD and it sent her into spirals of depression, feeling trapped, you know, in her mind until we found the right medication and the right therapist. And then she was able to manage the OCD and then became like this rock star, which was really beautiful to see her embrace her sexuality. She came out as this proud lesbian. I call her a proud lesbian warrior for social justice because she was just fierce in her protection of the oppressed. Any kid that was being picked on, Ruby would like take up the mantle and, you know, stop it because she was that powerful. But she created beautiful works of art, digital art. She did animation. She did line drawings, pencil drawings, painting.
Wow.
Everything.
They both sound like super creative.
Yeah.
Just like in touch with themselves in an incredible way at the ages in which they were.
Yeah.
You know, that's pretty rare for those ages.
Yeah.
So tell us what happened.
So it was June 12th, 2019. And we were taking a family road trip to Joshua Tree, which is it's in the high desert, about 2.5 hours east of Los Angeles, for those of you who don't know. It's a sweet little town with amazing rocks and trees. The Joshua trees are amazing. Mm-hmm. And there are special trees that are only found in certain very few locations on Earth. And one of them is in Joshua Tree, where they're there by the thousands. So it's a very special kind of magical place. And we'd be going out there all their lives. So all four of us love scrambling up these rocks. They're fun rocks to climb. And we had looked at this home as like a vacation home, this little small kind of rundown cottage, but with amazing views. And we're like, wow, this is a magical place. And we bought it and we were going back there, having just said, yes, we want to buy it, to just look at it again one more time. And we were struck, it was nighttime, and we were struck by a drunken high driver going 40 miles above the freeway speed limit. And she never even touched the brakes. She was so drunk and high. And Ruby and Hart were killed in the backseat. And Hart was 14 and Ruby was 17. Mm-hmm. And then my wife, Gail, and I, we were suddenly in a whole other world, right? And our whole lives and all the future we thought we had were taken from us. And we felt shattered and had to figure out a way to mourn and process our grief.
Mm-hmm. And so it hasn't, I mean, it's only been, what, not even coming up on 4 years.
Coming up on 4 years, that's right.
And you take us in this book through the process of your grief, but also really the process of probably most people's grief, despite what so many say about there is no one way to grieve.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what, I mean, you've been in grief groups, you've worked very closely with your rabbi, it sounds mm-hmm. like, and your community to embrace and kind of like hug grief in as tight as you could.
Yeah.
To come out. I don't even want to say come out, because I don't think you ever come out of this, but to still live, I guess would
yes.
be.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to put it, right? You know, how do we stay in life and still grieve, still be in touch with that grief, but not be trying to compartmentalize it in a way or be overwhelmed by it.
Mm-hmm.
I found for me, if I was just sitting around feeling sad, I would be overwhelmed with my grief. It would send me into despair. But if I was able to take action in grief either have a ritual or a ceremony or talk to a friend about Ruby and Hart or my grief, or even just little things. Like I'm actually wearing a shirt of rubies right now. Mm. She loved, I can see,
oh,
I can stand
it. Oh, I can't see. Let me.
There's like an octopus. Yes. Ruby loved octopuses, and this is her shirt, and she loved it. And I have tattoos. These are Ruby's designs. These wolves that she did.
Is that I know you talked about the wolf you feed, that
yeah.
Famous kind of quote about which kind of part of your psyche are you going to engage with?
Mm, right, right. Is it going to be the joyful side or the bitter side, right? Mm-hmm. The rage and envy or the love? So I try and feed the love. But and how do we reconnect to meaning and purpose? Mm-hmm. That seems so important to me, because at the time life felt meaningless. I had no purpose. Mm-hmm. That's what it felt like to me, losing Ruby and Hart. And I did not like that. I did not want to sit in that despair. And so I knew I had to sort of take some kind of active steps towards re-engaging with life.
And where do you even begin when you lose in such a profound way? I mean, that's anybody who has children, it becomes, you can't imagine it before you have kids, and then you have kids and your identity becomes
right
being their parent in so many ways.
Yeah.
And so as a parent losing both kids at the same time, mm-hmm. where do you start? Like, what's the first step?
Yeah, what's the first step? That's a great question. No one's asked me that before. What's the first step?
I always like to try to ask. I love when someone says, no one's asked me that before. I'm like, yes.
The very first step. Wow.
How do you pick yourself up off the floor? How do you roll out of bed in the morning?
Yeah. I think, what's the first? Well, I'll stick an early step. I don't know if it's the first step, but there's a whole lot of denial. It seems like that's a pretty universal reaction, that it's literally, you cannot believe it. You cannot believe that they are actually gone from this earth and you will never see them again. Mm-hmm. And you're alive and they're not. It is really hard to believe. Right. And it takes a long time to believe it. And the denial, you know, works in very strange ways, where your brain is working to try and fix it, to try and get them back, right? And so you do all sorts of very strange things because part of your brain is trying to get them back.
Well, it's almost like I think denial too can be like a real safety mechanism, mm-hmm. right? It's like, we'll open the dam a little bit mm-hmm. for you. But if that reality came in, you know, full force, I feel like you drown.
Maybe. Yeah. 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 There's a grace to it that I read, you know, in a book described as a grace in denial. But ultimately, I feel like denial is not our friend. I feel like pretty early on, I wanted to actively get away from denial. Mm-hmm. I did not like living in this world that wasn't real. The world where Ruby and Hart were still alive. Mm-hmm. I didn't like it. Didn't leave me feeling good.
Mm-hmm. Because you'd at some point realize it wasn't real.
Yeah. Yeah. I knew it wasn't real. I mean, I buried my children. Right. I was there when they were killed. I saw them, their bodies. So I knew they were dead, but, and it did not give me relief to sort of imagine that they weren't. So that sort of confrontation with denial is sort of the first or one of the early steps. In the Jewish traditions, so my book is a lot, I'm not Jewish, but my wife's Jewish and our kids are Jews. We raised them as Jews and they got bar and bat mitzvahed. And that was very meaningful to me and to them, especially to Ruby. And so I leaned on the Jewish traditions of mourning. And they helped me a lot, and they taught me a lot of very valuable lessons about literally how do you grieve, you know. And so one of the early lessons was about denial, you know. So it's a Jewish tradition that the parents, we put dirt from our hands onto their caskets, and then we sat and watched our entire community finish burying them. They continued burying them. right in front of our eyes. And it seems on one level like cruel, like, why don't you just get these parents out of there? But actually, no, it's in a way it's so helpful. And so many of the Jewish traditions are like that. Like, you don't have one night of Shiva. It's the whole week of Shiva.
Right.
People keep coming to your house, and you're supposed to say the mourner's prayer every day for the first year. Mm-hmm. And you can't say the mourner's prayer all by yourself. You have to say it in community. There have to be at least mm-hmm. 9 other people with you, you know, a minion. And so there you are weeping in front of other people and saying these words that are in a way acknowledging the death of your loved one, and your community is essentially amening your proclamations of grief. That's mm-hmm. how I look at it. You know, some people might say, oh, they're saying amen to God, but because I'm not religious, it felt to me like they were saying amen to me and my wife, you know, publicly articulating our grief, mm-hmm. which is a beautiful, beautiful thing to my mind.
And it really sounds to me in reading like those rituals, and I always say, because I'm Jewish, my listeners know this, we in the Jewish faith, we do milestones, all of them, birth to death, quite well. Like, I think particularly death, in terms of how you acknowledge the dead, how you continue to acknowledge them for years to come, right? With what we call Yahrzeit every year, at the year mm-hmm. of their death, their names are read, so they are not forgotten.
Yeah.
And I do think there's something, and when I've worked with patients who are not of either any faith or particularly Jewish faith, it feels a bit like there's like flounder, like you're kind of, you know, throwing your arms up, like, someone throw me a lifesaver here. Yeah. Because there aren't those real kind of prescriptive ways of grieving that the community then supports.
Right, right. The public acknowledgement of our loss. It's so powerful. Because the alternate is so isolating, mm-hmm. you know, to have nobody talk about Ruby and Hart is so difficult for me when it happens, right? It's like, this is, it drives me crazy, like literally crazy, because how can this be? These two people were such a huge part of my life and the lives of all the people around us. If we're not talking about them, not constantly, but just a little bit, like just acknowledging that they once were here and they're so impactful, it can make me feel like I'm insane. Mm-hmm.
And so what happens when that time is over, the Shiva, right, which is mm-hmm. 7 days, and then the first month is Shloshim, which is the 30 days.
Yeah.
And then it's done. Mm-hmm. And everybody else gets back to their lives, and maybe they run into you at the grocery store or on the street, but their lives go on and yours is
in a different place.
Well,
one of the beautiful lessons that my wife and I learned from Shloshim is that, again, for those of you who don't know, you're supposed to mark it in some way. So the first 30 days, once they end, you're supposed to mark it with some sort of a ceremony, which we took to mean a public ritual, a public gathering. And but you're supposed to do it, but they don't tell you what it should be, what it should look like. Mm. There's no rules about what you're supposed to do to mark the end of Shloshim. You're just supposed to mark it. And so Gail and I, we created our own ritual. And maybe, you know, we're theater people, so maybe we're more comfortable creating rituals because theaters come from ritual, but in the first place, but we gathered a bunch of friends, out in this park that meant a lot to our family. It was the Los Angeles Arboretum. We'd gone there many, many times their whole lives. We all four of us love that place as well. And we dedicated two trees, and their branches happened to intertwine like they were hugging each other. It was a spectacularly beautiful spot. And it's kind of in a wild corner of the park, the far, far corner. We saw a whole pack of coyotes stroll by at one point. And so we're like, wow, this place is wild, like mm-hmm. literally wild. Ruby and Hart would have loved it to be this the place that we're going to mark their presence at the park with trees. So we dedicated these two trees, and we gathered our friends, and we told Ruby and Hart stories, and we all wept. And a friend sang a beautiful song, and our rabbi was there, and she, you know, said some prayers and then talked about Ruby and Hart and grief. And we all had a moment of silence. And so that kind of empowered Gail and I. We're like, well, next time we're feeling empty or alone or aching, we can always just have another ceremony. Mm-hmm. We can gather some friends. It doesn't have to be a huge gathering. We can just gather a couple of friends, right? And have a moment to talk about Ruby and Heart. And that's going to help us. Mm-hmm. And it has over the years. We've marked, you know, because every holiday is a challenge. For those of you who are grieving, you all know this. It's like literally every holiday, right? Like, you know,
not just the first time around.
Not just the first time.
Right.
Forever. Forever. Right. So, you know, Valentine's Day, you'd think Valentine's Day, well, that's not about kids, but it was for our family. You know, at one point when Heart and Ruby were older, Gail and I told them, you know, we're going to go out for a romantic dinner. And Heart said, how can you? Valentine's Day is a family holiday. We had to tell them, well, technically it's not. It's actually a romantic holiday, but we had always treated it like a family holiday. Mm-hmm. So that means that for the rest of my life, Valentine's Day is going to be emotionally challenging, beautiful, and also sad because mm-hmm. Ruby and Heart aren't here. Mm-hmm. So, you know, their birthdays,
which were a day apart.
A day apart, 3 years and a day.
3 years and a day.
Yeah. Hers is March 29th and his is March 30th. He was born 3 years and 1 day later. And those are hard times. And how are you going to do it? How are you going to get through those days? And I found if we lean into it, don't like pretend they aren't there, but lean into the pain of it and try and find some way to honor them, honor our grief, be in community in some ways, we found it to be very helpful.
Mm-hmm. And it sounded like you and Gail grieved together. You know, a lot mm-hmm. of, this is kind of common out there that a lot of couples after the loss of a loved one, after the loss of a child, grieve separately and it ends up destroying their marriage. And it sounds like in many ways you and Gail have really like leaned on each other and been able to be there for each other.
Yeah. Well, I did want to mention statistically, it's not true that the rate of divorce is higher amongst people who've lost children, which is interesting. Mm-hmm. So I'm not trying to minimize the struggles of couples after their children die. There's big struggles, right? But actually, I think there is also a false narrative that's out there that says mm-hmm. that most couples will divorce. And statistically, it's not true. The rate of divorce is actually lower than the national average because there have been nationwide studies conducted by Compassionate Friends, mm-hmm. which is a nationwide bereavement organization for children, for parents, grandparents, and siblings who've lost. And so at any rate, but yes, to answer your question, Gail and I, we did tend to grieve in very compatible ways, even if we were in a different mindset, you know, moment to moment or hour to hour, we certainly both agreed that we were going to lean into the pain of our loss. We were going to talk about Ruby and Heart and our grief, and we were going to hold rituals together to help us. And I think I've heard from many couples who do struggle with the idea that they grieve differently. And I kind of feel like, well, they're not really grieving differently. One is trying to actively grieve and one is trying to avoid the grief. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I would just encourage people who are struggling to not avoid the grief and talk about it. And that's going to really, I think, bring you together with mm-hmm. with your loved one, whether it's a spouse or a sibling or whoever else you're grieving with, you know. If you can share, if you can find a way to share your feelings and the pain and the loss, it's going to be so much less suffering mm-hmm. as you grieve together. I think the suffering part is what we want to try and avoid.
Can you talk about what defines suffering? And
yeah.
So you talk about pain, suffering, and despair.
Yeah, yeah. So, I got this idea from Megan Devine. So I always want to credit her because she really helped her book. It's Okay or Not Okay really helped me in early grief. But I don't think she invented it though. That's where I got it. That's where I received it. But the idea is that, you know, we're going to experience pain. We love somebody, they're gone, that hurts. That's just how it is. There's no way to, you can't escape it. That's the price you pay for love. And that's okay.
Well, and I think the hurt of it, particularly in Western culture, is that we try to cure everything.
Right, right. You're trying to fix things, right? Trying to comfort and reduce the pain, but you can't reduce that pain. You've got to experience it, and it's okay because it comes from love. And so it hurts, but it's bearable. I believe we can all bear the pain of loss as long as we're not trying to run from it. If you try to run from it, then maybe it becomes unbearable. But if you let yourself feel it, we can all bear that pain. But then there's suffering, and the suffering part, the idea there is that that's not actually the healthy pain of loss. That's the unhealthy junk that comes along with the time. So like suffering is like being abandoned by your friends and family. That's like suffering. You feel alone in your pain. That's not honoring your loved one. That's just you suffering loneliness. And then guilt, you know, guilt and regret. These are things that are going to come. You can't avoid them, but if you can see them as suffering and not in a way honoring the beautiful life you shared with your loved one, if you can allow those feelings to pass as best you can, you know, right? Don't dwell in the guilt and the regret, because that's going to lead you to suffering.
So just noticing, like, I'm feeling guilty today, which you felt quite often.
Oh yeah, every day. I feel guilty every day, sadly.
Yeah.
But I just try not to dwell in it.
Right. And you go back and replay what happened, which I think is really common.
Right, right. Yeah.
As well.
I do that less now. Thankfully. But the thoughts certainly come to my mind. All the ugly self-punishing thoughts come to my mind all the time, but I just try not to dwell there because I just know that it's not helping anybody.
And then, right. And then you talk about despair and the potential to slip into that place of, you know, just complete devastation and despair
and hopelessness
and the desire to die, which you had, which I would think I would also have if I experienced what you experienced. So how do you walk through that desire without doing anything? I mean, you and your wife and your kids are gone, and your identity, and like, how do you not just want to say I'm out?
Yeah. Well, a couple of things. One is that I thankfully never was actually suicidal. So I never had plans. I never thought of actually ending. I just felt the feeling of not wanting to live without them. You know what I mean? So I think that is an important distinction.
Yes.
Because suicidality is another level of suffering and despair that you need help, that you need to get help right away. I think if you're suicidal, you're not going to fix it on your own. You need help right away. So I was never actually actively suicidal, but I did definitely have many times when I did not want to be alive. And
sort
I think
of that passive. That's kind of that passive ideation
despair
that we talked about. Yeah.
And I thought one thing was that Ruby struggled with suicidality. So she actually did feel suicidal. And she fought hard to not be suicidal. And she tried so many different medications and so many different therapists because she kept trying to engage in life. And eventually she did find the right therapist and the right medication. And she emerged from her suicidality and OCD and depression, and it was beautiful. And so on one level, I was like, there's no way I'm going to end my life, because how could I do that to Ruby? She fought so hard, and then her life was stolen from her. My God, she, you know, if she was out there in the universe, she'd be so angry at me, right? I couldn't do that. I couldn't dishonor my child. That's really what I felt like. I will not dishonor Ruby. Not to mention what it would do to my wife, right? And all my friends and family. After having seen and experienced what it's like to lose somebody, I'm not going to inflict that on other people that I love. My God. But again, I wasn't struggling with real suicidality or depression. So that's a different, you know, that's a different mental health crisis. And then the despair. And then I also thought about, again, taking action, rituals, community. So I think the hard part is that when you feel that despair, you want to be isolated, right? You want to go to by yourself. And same thing with early grief. You're like, I don't want anybody around me. I can't take it. But actually Shiva taught me that that's not true. I actually did want people around me. I did need to talk about Ruby and Heart and my grief to other people. And that was a very valuable lesson, because every night of Shiva, I would be like, oh God, they're coming. They're coming again already. It's already time. No. And then here they come. You know what I mean?
Right.
The door opens.
For
oh,
four
God.
Hours, it's like a barrage of people.
But then I was always left feeling like, oh, this is wonderful that I get to do that. I get to talk. Not wonderful is not the right word, I guess, but because it wasn't wonderful. But
it's very
it was
supportive.
Yes. And necessary.
Yeah.
It felt necessary to me. Yeah. And so I guess, you know, in the moment of despair, you feel like closing yourself off, but actually you need to do the opposite. You need to get out and reach out and take action. And so I think I sort of learned that viscerally, like whenever my instinct says, no, I don't want the pain. I don't want the people. I don't want life. I'd be like, uh-oh, no. Alarm bells. That's wrong. And I would say, yes, I would say yes to help. Yes to people. Yes to doing something out in the world.
Well, and the book really walks through so many different steps and prompts and rituals and things that people can do. What I found so touching was the letters that you would write to friends or the letter that Gail wrote when she went back to work around helping people to be comfortable around you, you needed, which a lot of people will say, well, I don't want to have to do that. I shouldn't have to educate other people around how I'm grieving. They should know, or they should do this, or they should do that. Why did you do that? And what did you find when you did?
Yeah. No, I think that's exactly right. That it's so prevalent, the idea of like, why should I educate all these people? I'm the one that's suffering. And I think I felt like I might have been sort of uniquely empowered, because I would have definitely been the person to avoid somebody in grief, 100%. So I had a lot of sympathy and compassion and understanding for people who wanted to avoid me, because I was definitely in their camp, you know, times 10. Mm-hmm. So I think it was easier for me to think like, oh my God, these poor people, I need to help them help me. Because otherwise I'm going to be alone. Mm-hmm. Because if the world's like me, right? I'm in trouble. My old me, if the whole world is like old me, then new me is in big trouble.
Right.
I better say something to these people. And then, some people say like, oh, it must take a lot of like, not confidence, but it's hard to say what you need to your friends, right? It's definitely an act of like
courage.
Yeah, courage, and you know it's going to be socially awkward. You don't normally tell your friends what to do, right?
Right.
How to talk to you. This is how you need to talk to me.
Right.
But I knew my friends loved me, and I knew the stakes were so high for me. Mm-hmm. I was going to lose my mind if I couldn't talk about Ruby and Heart and my pain. I wasn't going to make it. So if it was going to be a little socially awkward to tell some close friend, listen, you need to say Ruby and Heart's names right away. You know what I mean? That doesn't seem so hard to me in context. It didn't seem hard to tell people what I needed. And then I got, Gail and I both got amazing positive feedback right away, because it was so helpful to my friends and family, right? They wanted to be told what to say and you know, what how we should talk, the ground rules to make them feel safer.
Well, and this notion of, you know, people say, well, I don't want to remind them of as if you're going about your day and they say to your kids' names and you're like, oh yeah, I forgot about them. You know, like, I mean, I'm sure every minute of every day is basically their act. So it's not a reminder. It's in some ways an honoring.
And it also just helps me not be like I haven't lost my mind, because you're thinking about my children too, right? Because you knew them also. You're also grieving my children. My children were such wonderful people that so many people love them. You know, they're all in pain, these people, right? They're all rocked.
And they mattered. I think that's I think at the core of what so many of us want is to know we mattered. And to know that our lives mattered and that our families mattered and you know, that your kids mattered not just to you, but it sounds like they touched so many other people as well. Yeah. And often we don't know, like, I think too, when you lose a child, you don't necessarily always see all that whole world, teenagers in particular, that they that they orbit in, right? Like, they have friends and kids at school, and you might not know all those people.
Yeah. And if you get to talk to them, you get to hear stories that you would never have known otherwise. Yeah. Which we got to do. We got to hear stories about our children. So that was an amazing gift.
And you asked for their birthdays for people. Was that for their birthdays? To write, to write
letters.
Write letters and stories that you would have.
Yeah. Yeah. That was very powerful. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't our idea. It was a friend of Ruby's. She just, you know, Yaya, she said, can I write Ruby a birthday letter? And we're like, oh, that's a great idea. We would love a birthday letter from you and from actually everybody that knew them. That would be an amazing gift.
How many did you get?
140.
No way.
Yeah, 140 letters. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, yeah, it was really amazing. Yeah,
what a gift!
And we read, each one.
You know, I would read each one every day. I would have would be next to my bed in the morning.
We created a whole ritual where we were up in Joshua Tree at that house, which became like a grief retreat for us. And then it was during the pandemic, also, so it was all locked down. But we would walk for about a half an hour up this beautiful hike to these beautiful rocks, surrounded by other rocks out in the wilderness, and we would read these letters aloud to Ruby and Heart spirits, like 8 letters a day. That's all we could do, all we could handle. And we would weep, and it was hard but beautiful, you know. That's kind of the journey.
Hard but beautiful. This saying, the title of the book, Finding the Words, is sort of a play on, I don't know if it's a play on, but on this notion that people say when you lose a child, which is there are no words, right? Like people come up to, I can envision it watching other people at Shiva's being like, don't go there, right? Like they just come up and there are no words, which is, I've often said is not, I don't believe that's true. I believe there are plenty of words. I also think when people say, like, I can't imagine what you're going through, it's like, no, you can.
Right.
You don't want to go there.
Right.
But you can imagine it, because it's, you know, the to me, I think it's one of the worst things you could experience in life.
Yeah.
And so you can imagine it, but people don't know how to put that into words, right? So they just say, there's nothing I can say.
Right,
and it becomes about their own discomfort. So what are the words in those moments that people can say?
Yeah, yeah. So I wanted to say the title of my book, it does reference that for sure, but mostly it's aimed at people who are grieving, finding their own words, you know, to literally process their own grief. But in terms of like, what are the words to say to grieving people? I think in a way, some of the words that Ruby and Heart's friends came up with were the most powerful, which was they simply shared their feelings of love and loss. They just came up to us.
They weren't filtered by being afraid of doing or saying the wrong thing.
Right. No one had taught them yet the phrase, there are no words. Mm-hmm. I guess you learn that when you're like 20 or so. I don't know what happens. At some point you learn that's the phrase, right. And then everybody just says that and you're right. Done. But so these kids would just share about how they loved Ruby and Hart and how much pain they were in. And then we could talk about Ruby and Hart. But the real thing is that I think people who love people who've lost somebody dear to them are trying to give comfort. They're trying to take mm-hmm. away the pain. And that's when you get into trouble because you can't take away their pain. And if you're trying to, you're going to inevitably say things that are going to rub them the wrong way in one way or another, because mm-hmm. you're trying to minimize their pain. And people in grief need to feel that pain and need to feel that pain be valid and validated mm-hmm. as opposed to erased or minimized. Right.
Right.
Any attempt to try and comfort somebody is actually going to backfire in my mind. And so really what's most helpful is for people to be listening mm-hmm. to people in grief, to be with them in their pain and not be afraid of their pain. This I talk about in the book. The very first lesson I learned about that was taught by a doctor in the pediatric intensive care unit that was taking care of Hart in his final moments. Mm-hmm. And Hart died of three life-ending injuries. So there was no chance for him to survive. They tried valiantly, but they couldn't stop any of these three life-ending injuries. So she pulled us aside in the room and she told us that this truth, that Hart was just being kept alive for a few more moments so we could, you know, say goodbye to him before they pulled the plug, but that he was gone, right? And then instead of being frightened of our pain, she leaned in and said, tell me about Ruby and Hart. And so she wasn't giving us words of comfort, right? She wasn't telling us it's all going to be okay, or mm-hmm. they're in heaven, so don't worry, or you'll see them again, or, you know,
plan.
Right. There was no attempt to try and fix our pain. In fact, she was leaning into it and saying, tell me. And because she knew we were going to be weeping and right and convulsed with pain. But she gave us an action, which was to tell a story about Ruby and Hart, mm-hmm. A life-affirming action in our moment of the deepest, first moment of shock and horror, right? Of being told that not only was our daughter dead, but now also our son was dead. Mm-hmm. And that was so, so amazing for her to be there with us in our pain. That's exactly that. She wasn't telling us anything. She was asking us, you know, tell me about Ruby and Hart. Mm-hmm. And that's the gift you can give people in grief, is to be there and allow them to tell stories and ask them the kind of questions that will allow them to think about their loved one in life, you know?
And you talk a bit about the afterlife, which I always talk about here. Tell us about your belief or lack of belief in the afterlife. How you see that as maybe a potential for spiritually bypassing grief.
Yeah.
And I'm also curious if you have felt, I always ask people, like, do you feel like you've experienced any signs mm-hmm. or connection or felt them since they've been gone?
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't want to step on anyone else's personal beliefs, right? So, you know, I want to get that caveat that mm-hmm. I'm not trying to put down anybody else's beliefs, because how we believe about, you know, life after death is very, very personal, obviously, but and important. But my belief, it's kind of a fluid, kind of mysterious feeling, because I have had moments, like I've had dreams where they've come to me in dreams, right? And sometimes they've turned into nightmares. Sometimes I have a nice moment with them, and then I remember in the dream, oh no, you're dead. Mm-hmm. In the dream, I remember this, and wake up, and it's brutal. But I have had beautiful moments with them in dreams, and certainly, you know, butterflies have landed and hummingbirds have come by, and it's nice. I feel it's nice to think about, oh, maybe they're visiting me. Or I also think, like, I think that they're watching me sometimes and thinking like, I'm making them proud, you know? Mm-hmm. But I think the deeper truth for me is that they're inside me, that they made me who I am. Mm. Their love and their presence and their minds, they changed who I am. So they're here. They're here present in me and my wife. And that feels real to me. Mm. The one thing I feel about like looking for signs is that I do become concerned for other people if they're really dependent on those signs.
Right.
Because then what happens if you're like, the hummingbirds are my children, and then there's no hummingbirds for 2 months? Do you get like despair? I don't know. Like, mm-hmm. where are my children? I thought they were going to be here. You know what I mean?
Right.
But like, well, so if you're able to just take the signs as just nice bonuses, mm-hmm. right? That's how I look mm-hmm. at it. It's like a, mm-hmm. like a gravy, like, oh, that's nice. A nice thought. That's sweet. That, you know, maybe that butterfly is like some kind of spirit of ruby and heart somehow. But I do believe that some people use the afterlife as a quick fix, mm-hmm. Especially when they're comforting people who've lost, you know, loved ones. Like, you know, oh, you're going to see them in heaven. And it's like, if you believe that, that's great, but you're still going to miss them on earth. You still get Correct. To mourn, right?
Right.
That it doesn't, you have to be allowed to feel the loss in this life.
Right.
Even if you believe you're going to see them, that's wonderful.
But that's not right now. Right.
They had a whole life that they were planning on living, and that was taken from them and taken from you. And right. it's going to hurt, and that's right. okay. So I do feel strongly about that. Mm-hmm. That if you do believe in an afterlife, you're still allowed to mourn because that's reality. Right. You still lost somebody. That's okay. You know, I think some people in religious communities feel like they're judged, like they're supposed to be done grieving by now because they should be joyous. Their loved one is in heaven, they're called to God. Isn't that wonderful? Mm. And it's like, well, even if that is wonderful, they're not here.
Right.
You get to feel that pain.
Right.
That's okay. Don't try and fix it.
And I think that robs you know? People of what it means to be human.
Yeah. 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 Cause you're living in denial that,
right.
Because you did have hopes and dreams in this life with this person, you know, that's real. That's a real loss.
Well, and we are such a society now of don't dismiss any feelings, right? Like how important it is for us to feel anything. But yet when it comes to grief, we're like, oh, no, but not that one.
Right.
You know, like that one we shouldn't feel. Yeah. Everything else, bring it on. But, you know, when we're talking about grief, you'll see them again. Don't worry about it. God's yeah. plan, whatever it is, to sort of minimize the intensity.
Yeah, yeah, because it's too scary. People yeah. are scared of it.
So I wanted just two more things. I feel like there's so much to cover here. I could talk to you for hours. But you started fostering.
Yeah.
A child.
Yeah. yeah.
And I was really hoping for a happy ending.
Hmm. Yeah.
What made you put your heart out there again in that way?
Yeah.
Fearlessly, bravely.
yeah. Hopefully, right? Hopefully. Well, it was actually Ruby's idea. I credit Ruby, mm-hmm. you know, like 2 years before she was killed, she said to us, we should foster adopt. And Gail and I are like, what? First of all, how do you know? You're like, she was like 14 at the time. How do you know about foster adoption?
Right.
But she did. She's like, well, they're, you know,
speaking to probably how amazing they were.
Like, yeah, I think so. Right. She was super, super amazing. And so, and she said, you know, our family is so full of love and there are people out there who need families, who need this love and we could share it. I was like, that's so beautiful. And then it was about 2 weeks after the crash and Gail and I were aching. You know, it's so interesting. You're in a home and there's two empty bedrooms and it feels like, oh my God, once upon a time there were children in those rooms. What a privilege that is, right? What a privilege to have children in your home. Like, I can't even believe that I was so lucky that I had them in my house because now they're gone and I just feel It's horrible aching, right?
Well, and I was thinking about that actually last night as I was folding laundry, getting ready to interview you today. Mm. You know, yeah. And that moment that slips in, it's like more laundry, like this, right. This endless supply of laundry that seems to never end. And I had a moment where I thought of you and I was like, what a beautiful thing to be able to, I'm going to cry. To be able to fold my kids' laundry.
Your kids' laundry, absolutely. Yeah, and don't get me wrong, I was irritated plenty at Ruby and Har's kids, and like, oh my God, and I love taking vacations with just Gail and I, you know, escaping for a romantic getaway for a weekend. but now that they're gone, it's like, oh my God. So I said to Gail, just 2 weeks after the crash, I said, you know, we can still be parents again. We can foster adopt. And she said, thank God you said that, because I was thinking it. But I was scared you wouldn't want to, you know, because we lost our children. Mm-hmm. And that pain is so terrible. And so we took a chance. And the reality is this girl is quite an extraordinary girl. She's 16 now. And I, you know, I do love her. But she decided after a year and a half that she did not want to be part of a family. She did not want to be open. She couldn't open herself up to love and vulnerability because her history had been so, you know, catastrophic when she did do that. When she was a little girl and she opened up her love and her heart to her biological family who, you know, abused her, mistreated her, abandoned her, betrayed her, all these terrible, terrible things, right? And so it makes sense that she doesn't want to open her heart, you know. And so as she started to grow closer to us, I think she rebelled, she panicked and said, actually, I want to be left alone. I want to go back to a foster home that's not going to adopt me, that doesn't even speak my language. And I'm just going to be like ignored because I feel more comfortable being ignored. It's safer, you know, safer for her emotionally. And so I hope that on her journey, she's able to change and grow in a healthy way. But so she's somewhere out in the foster world, and we're in touch, you know, we text her now and again, and she's, and we have a nice relationship, I think, texting, but no details. She doesn't tell us any details about her life. But then just to further update you, Gail and I are now fostering to adopt siblings.
Oh.
Yeah. Brother, sister.
Wow. Yeah.
So he's 13 and she's 12, and they've been with us for 4 months now, and they're also wonderful kids. And now we know a little more about, like, it's a challenging road, right? We've been down a very challenging road fostering to adopt. And apparently it's quite common, you know, you foster to adopt a teenager and they're coming. They're more fully formed. They need family. They need love. And this first daughter of ours knew that. She's like, I know a family's better. I know I need a family, but I can't. Basically, that's what she said. And these two siblings, they also know they need a family. They do not want to be with their biological family. They've said no. We will not go back to them. And so they're on a path to adoption, and they need a family. And so we are hopeful. We're hopeful that this time it's going to work, and we're going to be a forever family.
It's such a beautiful. I mean, I'm like, can you foster adopt me? Like you just exude so much love that I can only imagine what it must have been like to be your children and for these kids to have the gift of that love.
Oh, thank you. But the reality is, and it's a tough reality, is that they have endured incredible loss and grief and trauma, right? Yeah. So these kids are, you know, a life of trauma. And so it's not like Annie. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's not just like, no. Oh, like love doesn't fix everything. You know, that's the tough lesson, you know? So we are engaged in parenting, right? We are parenting these youth.
Right.
And
you don't know what they're bringing. I mean, you know some of what they bring to the table, but right. not all of what they're bringing to the no. table and what no. their history and everything. So it's,
exactly.
it's a Herculean
yeah.
task. And yeah. I want to hear what happened. I'm going to check in on this. Cause
yeah. Yeah. Well, I sure hope it goes better than last time.
Me too. Me too. But, so yeah. I just want to end with this quote in the book.
I should show the book. I should do this.
Yeah.
I'm terrible at this. Look how pretty the book is.
It is so pretty. It is a beautiful
book. I love
book.
This design.
We're both showing the book. And I said to you before we started that it is, I read, everybody knows who listens, I read all these books. It is beautiful. It is comprehensive. It gives you real practical things to work on and to incorporate into your grief journey if you are grieving. It doesn't matter who you're grieving. It doesn't have to be a child. It could be anybody. No. And it's amazing. So this quote was a reminder to you, and it's from Welcome to the Grief Club.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And you say, the pain of their death is not the only bond you have left. Joy also connects you to them through the happiness they brought to your life when they were alive. Joy is not at odds with our grief, but rather an essential part of our healing. Joy gives us a bit of relief when it hurts too much to keep going. It provides fuel to keep living. Joy reminds us what we are living for. And yes. it seems to me you're able to carry the joy and the pain.
Yeah, yeah, I try.
Simultaneously.
Yeah, that's the goal. And I read that quote and I thought it was so beautiful. So I included it in my book. Because right. I was like, she put it perfectly. Welcome to the Grief Club. It's a great book. Yeah.
Well, Colin, thank you so much. Like we said, the book is Finding the Words, Working Through Profound Loss with Hope and Purpose. I cannot recommend it enough. It is it's just a beautiful read, even if you're not grieving. It's just a beautiful read. The eulogies at the end, what you share, you know, I mean, there's so much we didn't touch on today and so much more we could have. But just absolutely incredible. So, Colin, I'm so sorry for your loss of Ruby and Heart and what joy, and it sounds like how much they had ahead of them and could have brought to this world that so needs their kindness and specialness, and to Gail as well. And for you, being brave enough as a man, which we didn't touch on, in masculinity and grief. But as a man sharing this really profound journey and your ability to dig deep inside yourself and access those feelings and not run and hide from them, because so many do.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you so much.
Where can people find your work, your one-man shit show that's over?
Yeah. So on Instagram, I'm at Colin Campbell Writer, and I have a website, www.colincampbellauthor.com, and that's information about my book. And then my show is at www.griefaonemanshitshow.com, and that tells you information about my show.
Okay.
But yeah.
Great. Well, all of this will be in my show notes as well. So, Colin, thank you so much. Please keep me updated. I want to hear what happens with your two foster to adopt children. I'm rooting for you. I'm sure everybody that's listening is rooting for you and Gail as well. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Like what you heard today and want to hear more? Wondering what comes next and what it all means? Head over to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, or anywhere you get your podcasts and hit subscribe. Also, if you could take a minute to rate and review my podcast, I would really appreciate it. Stay tuned as we continue to explore life, death, and the space between.